You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hi, welcome to Blogging Heads TV. My name is Arya Cohen-Wade, and I'm the host of Culturally Determined. And my guest today is Omar El-Akkad. Omar, could you introduce yourself?
Sure. My name is Omar. I'm a writer. I'm based just south of Portland, Oregon. And a few months ago, I published my debut novel called American War.
So, American War, I'm holding it up to the camera right now. Striking cover. So this is a really interesting book, and the way it unfolds is interesting, so I want to talk about it in a way that gets people interested but doesn't really reveal all the twists and turns. So I guess my first question is, what drew you to the genre of kind of dystopian, post-apocalyptic literature?
It's a good question, and I've been asked that a couple of times now, and I so far have failed to find a satisfactory answer. I've read the classics in the genre. I've read The Handmaid's Tale, and I've read 1984. But when I was writing this, that wasn't the mindset I was in. Not much in this book hasn't already happened. It just happened to somebody far away, somebody who doesn't have much of a voice. Many of the things that take place in the book, I didn't really invent. I didn't invent waterboarding or refugee camps or drone killings. These are just things that tend to happen to people who are very far away. So in that sense, it's a dystopia for this part of the world. It's not necessarily a dystopia for the rest of the world. It's a somewhat exaggerated take on things that have really happened.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to give kind of a short, not summary, but introduction to the plot of the book, reveal as much as you think people need to get enticed?
Sure. So American War is the story of a second American Civil War that takes place about 5 or 6 decades from now. The America of 2075 is a very different place. Certainly geographically, it's very different. The sea levels have risen to such an extent that the eastern seaboard is now gone. Florida is underwater. Southern Louisiana is about 100 miles north of where it currently is. The capital has been moved from Washington, D.C. to Columbus, Ohio, and about 100 million people have moved inland as well to get away from the storms and the rising waters.
Right, so I'll just show to the camera some intriguing maps of the America of this era.
Right. So long after it would do any good at all, the federal government decides to impose a prohibition on fossil fuels as a way to combat climate change. And even though by this point most of the world has moved on to other sources of fuel, a number of southern states decide that they would rather secede than go along with this. What follows is the Second Civil War, the kinetic part of which is very short. The South loses almost immediately. And then there's a years-long insurgency. And the story is essentially the story of one family, the Chestnut family, and how they're caught up in the war and how the war transforms them.
So where did the idea that fossil fuels would be like kind of the animating issue that would cause like a new secession movement? Where did that come from?
I was thinking a lot about stubbornness. I've been to Southern Louisiana now a couple of times. I was working on a story back when I was still a journalist. I was working on a story about land loss in Southern Louisiana. That part of the world loses the equivalent of about a football field of land every hour. It's one of the biggest climate change disasters in America, and nobody talks about it. And I was thinking a lot about the idea of the notion that this is, if you live in Southern Louisiana, you have a choice between letting the oil and gas industry continue to do this sort of work and ruin the ecology of the place, or fighting them and fighting really the only source of revenue that this part of the world has, and essentially accepting abject poverty that would follow if this industry wasn't there. But when I was thinking about climate change, I was thinking a lot about this idea of something that many years from now, when it's safe to do so, we'll all be able to stand up and say, I can't believe that they didn't realize how wrong it was back then. If it was me back then, I would have stood up and said something. Mm-hmm. Ignoring that this wasn't some kind of temporary moral aberration, that instead it was the engine behind one of the biggest commercial empires in the world. And that it would have been very, very difficult to stand up against that kind of machine back when it was still in power. So that was the thinking behind it. I didn't think that the book would come out right at the time that the Trump administration pulled out of the Paris Agreement and that climate change would be the sort of central issue. I was thinking of it more as an analogy of the way we are very, very stubborn when it comes to continuing to do things we've always done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the that does make sense to me. And the parallel to slavery is there of something where today we view it with moral horror, but many people back then just viewed it as part of their world. This is a book projecting many years into the future, and I'm guessing it took you a few years to write it. How does the rise of Trump fit in with what you foresee in this fiction, or did Trump getting more and more likely as a presidential candidate while you were putting the book together, did that shape it at all?
The short answer is no. And I'm glad it didn't, because if I had tried to write this kind of book with the knowledge of the Trump administration's existence, I think it would have been a very different book, and I think it would have been a much worse book, because I would have been chasing a moving target. I can't predict what this administration is going to do tomorrow, let alone a year from now. I started the manuscript in the summer of 2014, and I finished it almost exactly a year later. And a couple of weeks after I finished it was when Donald Trump announced he was running for president. So to give you an idea, I thought right up until the end that he wouldn't win. I started to change my mind a little bit until when the Brexit vote came in. That's when I started thinking, maybe. But I thought right up until the end he wouldn't win. Anyway, so not only did I not predict any of this, had I predicted it perfectly and wrote a novel based on that kind of world in 2015, not a single publisher in this country would have run with it. They would have told me to tone it down. It might help move a few more copies to be writing a story about America going to war with itself and have it come out in this time period, but I didn't predict any of this.
Mm-hmm. I actually have had a previous conversation with a novelist named Sean Gandert, who wrote a satirical future set kind of dystopian novel, and he described the craziest when he started writing the novel, the craziest thing he could think for America to do would be to build a wall along the U.S.-Mexico border. So he put it in there, and he had corporations sponsor parts of it, so there's giant ads all over it, and then like reality caught up with his satire. So the narrator of this book is kind of tied up with, as the plot goes along, you learn more and more about it. How did you think about the narration and what did you think when you were deciding how to narrate the novel?
Yeah, it's a fairly convoluted way to put a book together. It's narrated, the book is set in the future, but that future is somebody else's past. So it's narrated by somebody who's looking back at what is our future. And the reason, technically the book is, I guess, first person, but for the vast majority of the book, it feels like a third person account of someone else's life. And one of the things I was trying to do was get at the violence of malleable history. The more time passes after something terrible happens, the more malleable it becomes in hindsight. I grew up in the Middle East. I grew up in a place called Qatar, and I went to a British school and we had our British history books, and I still remember the portions about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict being taken out of that book. We were not allowed to learn about that.
Mm-hmm.
And, regardless of how you feel about that issue, that is a piece of history that's being buried. It's a piece of history that's being buried for the purposes of changing it. And so I wanted this guy to be looking back at his life and looking back at the things that influenced his life and having that sense of that lack of agency, of not being able to do anything about it, of trying to get at a truth that has been buried. So that's why, some people picked up the book and looked at the back and saw 2075 and expected a sort of futuristic novel and hover cars and all of that stuff. It's not that at all. It's actually somebody else's past that we're reading about.
Mm-hmm. And you also include kind of documents, oral history excerpts from other voices in this world, which is an interesting technique. How did you decide to do that?
Yeah, it started as a crutch. I was putting this world together that had a lot of moving parts, and I was having trouble keeping up with all of the things that I've had happen. But I was a journalist for 10 years, so I have this familiarity with freedom of information requests, official sounding bureaucratic documents. You know, I spent my life going through these things. And so I started writing them. I started writing them to keep track of the dates and events and things that were happening. And it was only later on that I decided to try inserting them, to split up the chapters with these documents. I found that it lent the book an element of texture that otherwise I couldn't have gotten into the narrative. You know, the one source document that I keep going back to is in the sort of second half of the book. There's a letter from a detainee at a place called Sugarloaf, which is this detention camp that's very obviously based on Guantanamo Bay, but the letter has been passed through the government censors before it got out. And so when you pick up the book and read it, there's just black lines everywhere. There's mm-hmm. things that have blacked out. And when you listen to the audiobook, Dion Graham, who reads the audiobook, just says the word redacted over and over and over until it has this kind of numbing quality.
Uh-huh.
That's not something I could have done in a regular narrative. That's only in this kind of setup could I have gotten away with that.
Uh-huh. Why don't we talk about the main character? I pronounced her name Sarat in my mind. Is that how her name is actually pronounced?
Yeah.
So tell me more about her.
So Sarat Chestnut, when we first meet her, is a six-year-old girl living in her family's home, which is a repurposed shipping container by the banks of the Mississippi Sea, which is what the Mississippi River has now become in southernmost Louisiana. Essentially, the book is her story more than anything else. It's the story of her life. We follow her for the entirety of her life. And when we first meet her, I think her defining quality is this kind of very defined curiosity. You know, she wants to know as much as she can about the world around her, but she's also very loving. She's very trusting. She believes what people tell her about this world. And the central arc of the book, and I think the central tragedy of the book, is how that sense of trust is turned against her, both by the events of the war and also by people who would want to use her for their own ends. But to me, she's simply a person who wants to know. You know, she wants to understand this very strange world that she lives in, that's very different from the world her parents grew up in. And she's basically trying to get by living in a part of the world that's on the losing end of a war, which is a very difficult thing to do.
So plot points that are real life events that have happened in other parts of the world but haven't happened in America get transposed to the United States in this novel. And one of the interesting things is that the global superpower is no longer the U.S., but is a new country in the Middle East. How did you come up with that idea, and why did you put that in?
Yeah, so in the book, there's something called the Bouazizi Empire, which is this sort of pan-democratic Arab empire that runs from North Africa across the Middle East. And the idea being that there was an Arab Spring, it failed, there were three, four more Arab Springs, and finally after the fifth spring, the revolutionaries succeeded, and they overthrew the dictators, and they created this sort of, you know, from many states one. And effectively all I did was just steal the creation story of the United States and apply it to the Middle East and North Africa. A number of people from different backgrounds rise up against perceived tyranny, and from a number of different states they create one. And in the book, this empire is acting as a kind of saboteur. You know, they have agents in the U.S. The U.S. is in the middle of this ruinous civil war, and these agents are effectively doing their best to extend this war. Because for one empire to rise, the other one has to fall, and that's the role they're playing, which, again, is stolen from the idea of, for example, U.S. involvement during the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, where you see the rival empires in a quagmire, and you try to prolong that as much as possible. And, you know, if that means selling Stinger missiles to the Mujahideen, so be it. You know, if that turns around to bite us in the ass later on, that'll be somebody else's problem.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of it, you know, a lot of the book is concerned with this idea of turnabout and the idea that we behave in much the same way when we're subjected to these kinds of things. So that's where the idea of the Bouazizi Empire came from.
Mm-hmm. you know, this is not a traditional first novel. It's not like about your childhood, thinly fictionalized or anything like that. Did you, I guess it's hard to say why did you pick this to write, why was this your first novel? But, was there another work that maybe was like an apprentice work, or is this like the story that you first wanted to tell?
So it's the first published novel. It's the fourth novel I've written.
Okay.
The first three were, I think the literary term for it is not very good. so they never left the hard drive. I showed them to one or two of my friends, but I never tried to get them published, and they will never hopefully leave the hard drive. I don't know if this book is better or worse, and I don't know if it's a good or bad book, but I do know that what separates it from those other three is the feeling of necessity. You know, I think there's, you know, writing a book for me is very much an exercise in tolerance for self-loathing. You know, you start writing and it's a long, painful endeavor, regardless of what you're writing about. And so, you know, there's only really two reasons to go down that path. There's vanity or there's necessity. You know, I need to be heard or I need to say something. And this was the first one where I thought, okay, it may not be a good book. It may, you know, I don't know. I can't judge my own writing, but at least it feels necessary. It feels like something I would want to say to the world. And for that reason, you know, it's a more dangerous book, I think, than anything else I've written. Whether it's good or bad is a different story, but it has claws. You know, it's got a little bite to it. And so, yeah, that was the reason that I tried to put it out into the world, and I got very, very lucky. Knopf took an interest in it, and yeah, so that's where it came from.
Mm-hmm. You've worked in the past as a journalist. Do you still consider yourself a journalist, or do you see being a fiction writer as your vocation now?
Fiction was always my first home. Back when I was very, very young, I think third grade, I got a story in the student newsletter, and that was it for me. That was what I wanted to do with my life. Fiction is a good home for people like me who don't have a very good answer to the question, where are you from? You know, I was born in one place, I grew up in another, I'm a citizen of a third country, and now I live in a fourth. And so in fiction, you can sort of craft the contours of your world, which is very comforting for someone like me. Journalism was my home for 10 years. I still consider myself a journalist in the sense that I still pitch stories to my old newspaper, to other newspapers. But I quit my day-to-day job last year, and part of that had to do with the idea that you know, when it's good, journalism is really good. You know, you feel like you're changing the world, and you feel like you're doing it by simply telling the truth, which is a very empowering feeling. And when it's bad, you just feel like you're rewriting press releases. And I was tired of that feeling, and so I decided to take a chance on my first love and see if I could make a go of it.
Mm-hmm. Are you working on something else as a follow-up? Or, I guess my first question would be, would you consider revisiting the world that you created in a subsequent work?
The short answer is no. I lived in that world for a very long time. And I don't want to live in it anymore, for fear that A, it would be bad for my mental health, but B, that I would produce a worse version of it. And I don't want to do that. It might belong to somebody else. Somebody else might want to dive into that world and find something in it. But I certainly hope there won't be like sort of, you know, American War II or the American War, Fast and the Furious franchise, you know, Two American, Two War, or any of that stuff. That's not me.
Uh huh. It does seem like it kind of lends itself to, like, it could be a TV series or something. Have you thought about that at all?
We got a few offers, and that world was entirely alien to me. I never thought the book would get published, let alone that we'd get interest in the rights, you know, for film and TV. And because I didn't know very much, I really didn't know what to ask for. You know, I mean, there's obviously the money involved and that sort of thing, but that's not huge sums for optioning a book. So I asked for two things. I asked that they not tone it down so that, you know, I don't turn on TV 5 years from now and see American Peace. And I ask that they respect the racial background of the characters so that it's not just, you know, an entirely white cast or something. And that second request actually caused a couple of people who were interested to turn around and back away,
mm-hmm.
which is very fascinating insight into this world. You know, there's been some interest. I think probably it'll get auctioned. Whether it gets made or not is entirely beyond me, but I know so very little about that world, so we'll see how it goes.
Mm-hmm. So are you working on another novel?
I am, but like I said before, I have a 25% success rate with these things actually leaving the hard drive, so whether it sees the light of day or not, I don't know, but I am working on something else. It's a much quieter book than this, and I'm about 50 pages in. It's a repurposed fairy tale, which I think is a very disingenuous way of describing it, but I don't actually want to say what it's about, so I'll leave it at that.
Okay. I think those are all the questions I have, so American War, check it out. Omar, thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to Blogging Heads TV. You can help support this content by remembering to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. You can subscribe to all Blogging Heads episodes or to a specific program by going to our subscribe page at bloggingheads.tv/subscribe. There you can sign up for podcast downloads via iTunes or Stitcher, or you can subscribe to our email and we'll send you an alert every time we post a new episode.